And a good Tuesday morning to you. Welcome into the Nick Craig Show, streaming live on YouTube, Rumble, and X. Don't forget that you can take the show with you 24/7 on demand by checking out the Nick Craig Show in your favorite podcast app. You can also listen online by visiting the website nickcraig.com. Our show this morning is brought to you in part by The Law Group. Visit them online at lawgroupnc.com or give them a call at 910-251-6088. We have got a jam-packed show for you this morning, starting off with some local news across southeastern North Carolina. So tough times continue for the New Hanover Community Endowment. This was the group that was set up after the sale of New Hanover Regional Medical Center to Novant Health for like $1.2 billion. The hospital, previously owned by the county, sold to Novant. This endowment was set up as a avenue to manage the money from the sale of the hospital, and they started a community endowment, which is typically a pretty normal practice when you've got a large community asset like a hospital being sold. That's where you kind of see this endowment thing begin. And with that, well, we now have our third president, our third CEO within the span of just 4 years. Dan Winslow, who has been on the job for less than a year, has officially resigned his position. Winslow is stepping down to, quote, focus on personal priorities, according to a news release yesterday. The endowment board of directors appointed Sophie Denegas, the endowment's vice president of program and grants, to serve as the interim CEO. The former CEO, Dan Winslow, wrote in a press release yesterday, leading the endowment and getting to know the people of New Hanover County has been a true privilege. I've made the difficult decision to step away to focus my time and attention on other priorities. While this wasn't an easy choice, I am proud of the work we've done in partnership with the board, staff, CAC, and strong network of partners in New Hanover County to introduce the Grant Rainbows and further define the community's strategic vision. I am confident that this work will continue and truly transform the county. Winslow joined the endowment last fall as its new president and CEO, according to a commentary from the board chair, Shannon Winslow, no relation. She wrote, thanks to Dan's leadership, we've made significant progress and built momentum towards transforming New Hanover County. Dan has played a critical role in operationalizing the endowment's vision and building a talented team to carry the work forward. We're grateful for his contributions and wish him the best in his next chapter. Last August, endowment officials announced their selection of Dan Winslow as the next leader of the organization. His background included being a former trial judge, former legislature in the legislator in the Massachusetts House of Representatives, and did previously serve as chief legal counsel to former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney. Before joining the endowment, he led the Boston-based New England Legal Fund, NELF. During his tenure, the endowment announced a new approach to its grant-making process, providing strategic and responsive grants in various investment categories that Winslow referred to as the endowment grants rainbow, and brought on new personnel and added new positions. With this departure, now the interim CEO, joined the endowment just earlier this year, will lead its day-to-day operations, according to the press release. She previously served as an assistant dean at the Syracuse University and led the Baltimore Civic Site at the Annie E. Casey Foundation, which is a $3.4 billion charitable organization dedicated to improving the lives of children and families across the United States. So, obviously, not a good look for the endowment. You've got this organization set up in 2021, or it may have actually been set up in 2022, and you've now already had its now third CEO. The original leader in was in that position for a little over a year, resigned his position, Dan Winslow comes in latter parts of last year. He has officially resigned his position effective yesterday, and now the hunt of the search will be on to find another individual to lead the endowment. And, you know, I think the community, and rightfully so, has been relatively critical of the endowment. You know, one of my big frustrations that I've seen is we've got this $1.2-1.3 billion pot of money that is being managed by the endowment, and yet we still have both New Hanover County and the city of Wilmington funding nonprofit organizations each and every year during the budget process. And we just went through a knockout, drag-out battle here in New Hanover County over the budget, as members on the county commission, you know, the Democrats on that board, wanted to increase your property taxes and to fund all of these things, to fund pet projects, to fund nonprofits and other organizations. And let me make sure I'm clear with what I'm saying. I am not anti-nonprofit. I am not anti-charitable groups, nonprofit groups that are doing good work across our region. We are very fortunate to have an incredible group of local nonprofits. I take nothing away from the work that they are doing. But when you've got a $1.3 billion endowment, that is where that focus needs to be shifted. It needs to get away from the taxpayers of New Hanover County and the city of Wilmington and needs to be the sole responsibility of the New Hanover Community Endowment. That is where I believe that this, what needs to happen with this long term. With that pot of money sitting there, there is no reason that county or city taxpayers should foot the bill for nonprofits. Again, not because they're not good, not because they're not doing good work, but we have an alternate revenue stream. We have an alternate entity that has over $1 billion sitting in a bank account. It's obviously, of course, not sitting in a literal bank account. It's being invested, and the ROI on that investment is hundreds of millions of dollars a year. That's where that money needs to be spent. It needs to be shifted away from government and shifted off over into this other entity. Not only would it save the taxpayers of New Hanover County and the city of Wilmington potentially tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, it would save numerous hours of staff and other individuals within the county and city that are responsible for dealing with the allocation of these funds, going through the process of figuring out who's eligible, all of the resources, the human cost that is behind managing giving money to nonprofit organizations as a government, whether you're talking about the county or the city. And so I have been a strong proponent since the beginning of the New Hanover Community Endowment that this is something that needs to be completely shifted over to them. And for, you know, we've heard some commentary, at least in this last budget cycle, from individuals that seems like a good idea. And I hope that's something that our county and city leaders continue to push for. There's just absolutely no reason when you've got $1.3 billion sitting in the endowment that New Hanover County or the city of Wilmington should be responsible for funding nonprofits. It just doesn't make any sense. Now, some of the other frustration, and a lot of this is anecdotal, a lot of this is coming from social media commentary, but I think it's a pretty good, it's something good to look at. It's something that extrapolate some information from what some of the social media commentary is. And kind of where I fall on the endowment is this is supposed to be a group. This is supposed to be a pot of money that is helping everyone in New Hanover County. It's supposed to make transformative change across our broader area. Now, what does that mean? It's different for every single person, right? What is transformative change for me? What is transformative change for you? Can be drastically different. But one of the things that, you know, I've looked at as we've watched the endowment over the last 3 years allocate hundreds of millions of dollars to local groups, I don't feel like the impact, and I'm not trying to be overly critical of the endowment, but I'm just going to be honest as to where I fall on this. Not trying to be overly critical, but I don't find that the money that is being spent is having a dramatic impact on the largest group of people within the county. And what I mean by that is when you talk about funding these nonprofits, you talk about funding these groups, yes, that is important. But you're talking about the sale of what was a community asset, the New Hanover Regional Medical Center. And I am of the mindset that if the endowment is going to be allocating money, they should be looking at where can we put money that will have an impact on the most residents in New Hanover County, right? What can we do that will have the broadest and biggest impacts on the residents, on the citizens that allowed this to even take place on the first hand? That would be, of course, the sale of the hospital. There's been many ideas that have been thrown around. I think, you know, you look at the Cape Fear Memorial Bridge. There's a lot of discussion on how that is such an expensive project, how there's not necessarily all of the money available for that. I'm sure that doesn't fit necessarily into the vision statement or the mission of the New Hanover Community Endowment, but that's the kind of investment that I'm thinking of that could have an impact that lasts 40, 50, 60, 70 years on the community as a whole. And the vast majority of individuals would be able to take advantage of. Now, I'm not saying stop funding nonprofits. I'm not saying stop funding, you know, good work that goes on in our community. But as this endowment continues to grow, as more and more individuals get involved, I believe it is incumbent not only on the leadership of the endowment, but the community to express that, hey, there are bigger concerns, there are larger issues going on in our community that the endowment can help fund. And I'm not saying that $20,000 or $50,000 to a small group, a small nonprofit that's doing good work, I don't know that that needs to be cut out. I don't think that should be cut out of the process. But at a certain point, you've got to start looking beyond giving $25,000 to small groups and talking about actually affecting large-scale community change. While a nonprofit might be able to help a couple of people throughout the year, which is fantastic, again, not dogging on nonprofits. While a nonprofit might be able to help half a dozen people throughout the year with funding from the endowment, what about the other 200 plus thousand people in and around New Hanover County? Right. What about all of the other taxpayers in New Hanover County? What are they seeing as a result? What are they seeing as an ROI? And that has been one of the things that I have found frustrating with the endowment from day one is, well, not from day one, but as this process has rolled out, is that I don't know that the discussion is necessarily what is this larger change. Again, the example that just comes to the top of my mind this morning is the Cape Fear Memorial Bridge. Now, I don't think the endowment should drain its bank account to pay for the bridge. That's not what I'm advocating for at all. But if, you know, all of these funds start coming in and the bridge needs, I don't know, $250, $300 million, is that something that the endowment can deal with? Is that something that instead of looking at a tolled bridge to connect New Hanover to Brunswick County and arguably the rest of the state, is that something that the endowment can fill that gap on? That would be something when you think about and you talk about and hear about transformative change, transformative sums of money. But those are the things that I'm thinking about. And, you know, I'm looking at their most recent press release from July the 1st, the 12 new grants that they gave out to 12 nonprofits, $1.6 million. I recognize some of the names on this list. I look at some of the entities getting money. These are great groups. I'm not trying to take away from these groups. But as I look at this list, I think, how does this affect the vast majority of residents in New Hanover County? That is where my head is at. I'm going to be very curious if we find out any more backstory as to how this situation unfolded the way that it did. It seems very peculiar. I've never met Dan Winslow. Actually, that's not true. I did meet him once. Never had any private or personal conversation with him. It was a passing hello. Somebody introduced me to him back last year. So I'm curious what the story is here, how this whole process will continue to unfold, and if you know, where do we go from here? Because now the endowment is in a position once again where they're going to have to spend a whole crap ton of money going on this nationwide search to find a new CEO, all of this leading up to Dan Winslow resigning from his position in less than a year. The endowment does not do that in a cheap manner. They are going to spend a fortune searching for the next national candidate, go back to the well once again. And of course, it's going to delay any sort of strategic vision that continues. It's just a messy situation. Of course, there's still a lot of criticism of the sale of the hospital in the first place. Ladies and gentlemen, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. The hospital has been sold. It will continue to be operated by Novant unless they decide to sell it to some other healthcare group. That ship has sailed. That process is said and done. Whether you like it or not, whether you think it was a good idea or not, it's done. So you're not going to get that back. The question is, what can the endowment do going forward to affect serious change and have a major impact on the community as a whole? I have yet to see that part of the endowment. And hopefully, as they begin their extensive and very expensive search for the next head of the New Hanover Community Endowment, that is something that I would look forward to hearing about is, okay, what about the average taxpayer in New Hanover County, right? That doesn't, you know, isn't low income. So there's no ability to take advantage of what a lot of these nonprofits offer. What about the regular average middle-class taxpayer? What are they seeing as the result of the New Hanover Community Endowment? Those are my initial thoughts. Curious if we'll hear any more details, and I'm sure the endowment will begin the process in the coming weeks and months of another big old nationwide search for them to continue the process. So we'll keep an eye on those details right here on the Nick Craig Show. In some other local news this morning, candidate filing does continue across southeastern North Carolina and really the whole state for municipal elections coming up later this year. Some rumor earlier in the week and some conversation on social media about County Commissioner Dane Scalise potentially throwing his hat into the race for mayor. This was, of course, all predicated on the fact that there are two Democrats running for mayor. It is a nonpartisan election, but you've got two very well-known Democrats in current mayor Bill Saffo and former county commissioner Jonathan Barfield, who are both set to duke it out as mayor. And that could have potentially opened the door for a strong Republican candidate to come in and take over that leadership position, take over the mayoral seat here in Wilmington. However, according to a social media post from Commissioner Scalise last night, it reads as follows. Thank you to everyone who has asked me to consider running for mayor of Wilmington. I've been praying, discussing it extensively with my awesome friends and supporters, and have determined that I am exactly where I need to be right now. I know we would run a winning mayoral campaign, but I am more impactful and effective as a county commissioner. I was elected to get results for the people of this entire county, and I'm going to keep doing just that. So with this announcement, a couple of days left in candidate filing, it opens up or it closes at 12 noon on Friday, but obvious now from the social media postings from Commissioner Dane Scalise yesterday that he is not officially going to be throwing his hat into the ring for mayor. That is going to set a very high stakes race across the city of Wilmington, specifically for Republicans. Without a Republican candidate in that race, who do they back? It would seem to me, in my humble opinion on all of it, Bill Saffo is a much more level-headed, moderate person than Jonathan Barfield is, former county commissioner, losing his seat back in November of last year. And so we'll, of course, continue to keep an eye on candidate filing. Coming up early next week on the show, we'll go through the list of who is running in all of these various positions. Again, unaffiliated races, but many of these folks are registered, are aligned with one political party or the other. So it's going to be an interesting process to watch. We'll keep an eye on it right here. Yesterday morning, I was under the impression, and it was reported, that we would have been learning about who the new police chief was going to be for the city of Wilmington. However, that process has been slightly delayed. The city of Wilmington and the leadership there is completing the final stages of interviews for a new chief of the Wilmington Police Department, according to a spokesperson yesterday. Currently, the city is down to three candidates, all from out of state, according to Wilmington Mayor Bill Saffo. 45 individuals applied for the position, including candidates within the department. With Mayor Saffo saying, we've gone through a pretty elaborate process. It's been a long process. We know this is a very important and serious decision. I think I can speak on behalf of the entire council. We are very impressed with all three of the candidates that we were presented with today. Now, Mayor Saffo had previously told WECT News that the new chief would be announced yesterday, Monday, July the 14th. However, that process is taking a little bit longer than expected. Mayor Saffo says that you can expect that official announcement in the next 3 to 4 weeks. So, really the takeaway is that it is an out-of-state individual, so it is going to be somebody that is not already within local law enforcement, somebody that is not already within the Wilmington Police Department or the New Hanover County Sheriff's Office or potentially even statewide law enforcement. It is going to be somebody from out of the state of North Carolina that they are looking at as one of their final three candidates, and I guess sometime in between now and the middle parts of August, we will have that official announcement from the city of Wilmington as to who their new police chief is going to be. I covered this extensively on yesterday morning show. If you missed it, I'd encourage you to head on over to the website nickcraig.com or head on over to our YouTube channel and listen to the commentary, because there's a lot that's at stake. Not necessarily with the who the police chief is. Yes, of course, that's incredibly important, but the community's got a lot of frustration, a lot of questions. Right now, I would argue that the previous leadership of the Wilmington Police Department was pretty lackluster, especially at the top. So there's a lot that's at stake just for the position itself, regardless of who the individual is. I look forward to seeing who the city council announces as their pick, and we'll keep an eye on those details as well. You can encourage you to listen to yesterday's podcast if you missed it, and check out some of my thoughts on that, and we'll keep an eye on that for the next 3 or 4 weeks, according to Mayor Bill Saffo, before an official announcement from the city of Wilmington. We've got a lot more to get into this morning, including a major decision from the United States Supreme Court and President Donald Trump continuing to talk about frustrations dealing with Russian President Vladimir Putin. We'll get into those details here in just a few minutes. However, before that, when legal challenges arise, make sure you put your trust in the law group right here in Wilmington. Since 2003, their experienced attorneys have provided high-quality, affordable legal services across eastern North Carolina. Whether you're facing a divorce, navigating real estate transactions, or maybe you're in a position where you need a strong defense, the Law Group has your back. Their dedicated team ensures your questions are answered and issues are resolved promptly. I've got great news for you. They are located in downtown Wilmington and just a phone call away at 910-251-6088, or you can visit them online at lawgroupnc.com. That's 910-251-6088 or online at lawgroupnc.com. The Law Group, experience and dedication you can rely on. As I saw my Facebook memories over the last week, I closed on my home 5 years ago, used the great folks over at the Law Group to help me through that process. Would highly, highly encourage you to reach out and highly recommend them. 910-251-6088 or their website, lawgroupnc.com. We'll grab a quick break on the other side. The Supreme Court, Trump, Russia, and Putin. A lot to get into as the Nick Craig Show rolls on, streaming live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, and X, and 24/7, wherever you get your podcasts. Good Tuesday morning to you. Welcome back to the Nick Craig Show, streaming live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, and X 24/7, wherever you get your podcasts. A major decision out of the United States Supreme Court yesterday, and another big win for President Donald Trump. In a 6-3 ruling on Monday, the United States Supreme Court will allow President Donald Trump's Department of Education to resume efforts to slash its workforce in half. Now, this is, of course, the larger plan of completely dismantling the federal Department of Education and turning the authority over to states and, oh, I don't know, local board of elections to make decisions about what goes on in education. The decision reverses a lower court ruling ordering the reinstatement of the Department of Education employees cut loose in mass layoffs and ultimately allows Education Secretary Linda McMahon to continue her mission in winding down the department. The Department of Ed announced in March that it was reducing its workforce by half in an effort to streamline the department and cut down on unnecessary bureaucracy. Now, listen to this. I found this to be pretty shocking. Before the cuts, before March, and before, of course, Democrats sued and got in front of a friendly district judge, no surprise there, the Department of Education had more than 4,100 employees. 4,100 employees at the Department of Education. Let me make this as clear as I can. The Department of Education is not responsible for the education of a single child in America. The Department of Education does not teach a single child from C to shining C, math, reading, anything of the sort. There is no teaching functions, nothing within the Department of Education. Yet they have 4,100 plus employees. It's absurd. When you talk about and you hear people talk about the federal bureaucracy, this is it. The Department of Education is responsible for nothing more than putting barriers in place, roadblocks, and red tape for educators all across the United States. They are not responsible for educating a single child, yet there's over 4,000 people that are being paid as federal employees under the Department of Education. It is bureaucracy at its absolute worst. So the Department of Education announced in March that it was cutting its workforce in half. They were firing almost 2,000 employees and scaling down the size of that department. A number of senior department officials said that the more than 4,100 employees at the time existed largely to oversee contractors, add strings, and in many cases, do duplicative efforts across the department. Wow. It's a pretty damning set of statements from senior department officials. So you have more than 4,100 people that are just paying contractors, overseeing them, adding a bunch of government bureaucracy and BS to the whole system, and just doing a bunch of nonsensical busy work to justify having a cushy job at the federal government. Senior department officials said at the time the cuts would not impact student aid, the rollout of FAFSA by October the 1st, funding for special needs students, civil rights investigations, or any other functions statutorily mandated by Congress. And that in itself is how you can tell that there was too much bloat, that there was too much bureaucracy. When you can literally cut your workforce in half and still do all of the things that you do and are mandated to do by Congress. Right? This goes back to discussions that we've been having since the beginning of the year. When you look at cutting waste within government, if you have 4,000 employees and you can do the work with 2,000 employees, then you obviously don't need those extra 2,000 people. You obviously don't need them if you can continue to function. And again, the things that they're talking about that they're going to continue to do, student aid, FAFSA, which is dealing with funding for college, funding for special needs students, civil rights investigations, which they conduct, and all of the other functions mandated by Congress. So losing almost 2,000 employees, the Department of Education is still going to be carrying out all of its core missions. So why the hell were those people there in the first place? U.S. District Judge Myung Yang blocked the department's downsizing efforts in May, ruling that the administration needed congressional authorization. The judge ordered that the department reinstate approximately 1,400 workers who had been terminated. Another problem that we've been talking about since the beginning of the year. How in the hell does a U.S. District Judge have the authority to demand that a federal entity under the executive branch is responsible to hire back or have a certain number of employees. The only thing that the Department of Education is required to do are things that are mandated by Congress. And in its congressional charter, in all of its mandates, it does not say that you must have 1,000 employees or 3 or 4 or 5 or 6,000 employees. There's nothing in there about how big the department, how big the agency needs to be. And there shouldn't be, because that's absurd. You give the mandate to the agency and say, these are the things that you're responsible for. And then it's the agency head, in this case, former SBA administrator, Secretary Linda McMahon, it is her responsibility to figure out how many people we need to do the job. Why would you micromanage an agency like this through the court system? But that's the absurdity of all of it. You've got a U.S. district judge telling Linda McMahon you're not allowed to lay off people from the agency in which you are the head of. For all intents and purposes, you are the CEO of the Department of Education. You are the top decision maker within this federal entity. And you're not allowed to decide how many employees you need? You're not allowed to decide who the hell's working here and who's not, if we need these people or if we don't? Remove all of the politics here for a second. And I know it's hard. But let's remove all of the political stuff. DR, conservative, liberal. Just look at this at face value. Does it make sense that a judge, not Congress, but that a U.S. district judge, appointed, not elected, can tell a federal agency you must have a certain number of employees? You are not allowed to terminate individuals within your department. Now, if we were having an honest conversation, which I am, of course, the left is not, but if you were having an honest conversation with the left, which is, of course, very hard to do. But if you were having an honest conversation with them, they would say, no, of course not. There's no way that a federal district judge should have so much power and so much authority to tell an agency you must have 4,100 employees. You're not allowed to lay off 1,400 people from your agency. Nobody would argue that to the contrary. Now, Democrats are, because they don't like what's happening. They don't like what Orange Man and Linda McMahon are doing. So we're going to sue. Sue till blue. Sue till blue. So you had this judge say, you're not allowed to fire these people. You have to rehire them, which is insanely stupid. And so that's why you had the Supreme Court 6-3 decision yesterday. The majority did not issue an opinion to accompany the order, or it wasn't necessary for there to be one, which is not out of the ordinary. However, the court's three liberal-leaning justices dissented, decrying the ruling as indefensible. The losing opinion, as always, came from Justice Sonia Sotomayor, Justices Elaine Kagan, and Ketanji Brown Jackson, and it reads as follows. It hands the executive the power to repeal statutes by firing all of those necessary to carry them out. The majority is either willfully blind to the implications of its ruling or naive. But either way, the threat of our Constitution separation of power is grave. And when I read through this yesterday, in the first line, this is, again, from Sonia Sotomayor, Elaine Kagan, and Ketanji Brown Jackson. It hands the executive the power to repeal statutes by firing all those necessary to carry them out. How do these three liberal justices on the Supreme Court know that these 1,400 people are necessary to carry out what is congressionally required by the Department of Education? Sonia Sotomayor and Elaine Kagan are not in or anywhere affiliated or associated with the Department of Education. They have absolutely no understanding or no idea what is going on in that department. And for them to come out in their dissenting opinion and say, we know that you need these people to carry out your functions, goes to show you the pompous nature of the left. You know, I have to listen and read these commentary of them talking about the separation of powers and all of this other nonsense from the liberal justices on the court. Yet within separation of power, they believe as Supreme Court justices, they know how many employees are needed at the Department of Education. There is nowhere, anywhere in our founding documents, nowhere in our United States Constitution does it even hint at the idea that the United States Supreme Court has any idea how many employees are needed to carry out the Department of Education. Oh, by the way, because the Department of Education is not in the United States Constitution. Right? It did not start with the founding of our country. So let's just get that out there. Let's make sure we make this clear. The Department of Education is not constitutionally required. The Department of Education came out in the later days of what, the Carter administration? I mean, it's just absurd when you look at the Department of Education, you look at what is going on within this entity that has 4,000 plus employees and is really not responsible for a whole hell of a lot of anything. They're just managing contractors and setting up a bunch of stupid rules that local board of educations have to deal with. They're attempting to do one-size-fits-all education from Washington, D.C. One thing that we learned unequivocally, without a doubt, during COVID-19 is that one-size education doesn't work. Big, oversweeping, overburdensome rules as it relates to education doesn't work. You can't send every single kid home with a laptop and have them learn on Zoom and it be effective. Now, for some students, it's fine, but it's not fine for every student, and that's because everybody learns a little bit differently, right? That is the rationale, and that is the reason why you've got different methods of teaching that take place. This is why you see homeschooling and charter schools and private schools as such a popular thing over the last couple of years. Because many parents have come to the realization that one-size-fits-all education, a lot of it mandated by nonsensical regulations out of Washington, D.C., doesn't work for their kid. That works for most of the children, sure. You may even say it works for the vast majority of them. Now, that's an argument that we could have. That's a subjective determination of how education is done throughout the United States. But we know for a fact it doesn't work for everyone. So that's why something like school choice has become such a popular thing here across the state of North Carolina. So you've got this bloated federal agency. You've got a district court judge saying to Linda McMahon, you're not allowed to fire people that are solely under your discretion. And you've got liberal justices, Sonia Sotomayor, Elaine Kagan, and Ketanji Brown Jackson, saying they know how many employees are needed to operate the Department of Education. It's absurd. So this 6-3 ruling lifts the injunction as litigation plays out in lower courts, meaning that this could potentially go to the high court once again. Secretary Linda McMahon applauded the ruling as a significant win for students and families, she wrote yesterday in a press release. Today, the Supreme Court again confirmed the obvious. The President of the United States, as the head of the executive branch, has the ultimate authority to make decisions about staffing levels, administrative organizations, and day-to-day operations of federal agencies. While today's ruling is a significant win for students and families, it is a shame that the highest court in the land had to step in to allow President Trump to advance the reforms Americans elected him to deliver using the authorities granted to him by the United States Constitution. She continued by saying, the United States Department of Education will now deliver on its mandate to restore excellence in American education. We will carry out the reduction in force to promote efficiency and accountability and to ensure that resources are directed where they matter most, to students, parents, and teachers. As we return education to the states, this administration will continue to perform all statutory duties while empowering families and teachers by reducing education bureaucracy. So you just heard it directly from the head honcho's mouth. You just heard directly from Linda McMahon that as we continue to return education to this, I'm going to read this one more time for you. We're going to make this as clear as possible because the left-wing spin is already on all of this. Here it is for you. as we return education to the states, this administration will continue to perform all statutory duties while empowering families and teachers by reducing education bureaucracy. So you've got the head of the United States Department of Education saying, we're going to continue to do what we're required to do. So all of the pearl clutching, all of the hand wringing from the left about what Donald Trump is doing is unconstitutional. Everything that he's doing is shattering the Constitution. He needs congressional authority. We just heard from Linda McMahon, who said, we're going to do everything that we're legally required to do. We're just cutting out all the bullshit. We're just cutting out all the bureaucracy. We're just cutting out all the red tape. But the left, of course, is dismayed by this decision, dismayed by the idea that you don't need 4,100 employees in Washington, D.C. to have education in the United States. As the funding for the Department of Education has gone up, as that budget has ballooned over the last 50 years, education has continued to stagger in the United States. This is another example of the left's attempt to throw money at a problem to try and affect change. The Department of Education might be the greatest example of that. They have continued to funnel tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars a year into the Department of Education, and the end result is the United States on the national stage continues to slip in test scores, reading proficiency, math proficiency, and other sorts of metrics. It is not a good use of money. It does not make sense to continue to fund an entity that is allegedly responsible for education when test scores continue to fail, reading scores continue to shrink down on the list, and the whole education system continues to struggle in the United States. Why would you continue to fund this at its same level? The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. That is what we have seen out of the Department of Education. Continue to funnel money, continue to hire individuals. Meanwhile, scores are not improving. Reading and math proficiency is not improving. So at a certain point, you need to take a step back and say, maybe we need to look at doing something different. Maybe what we're doing is not sustainable. Maybe it's not a good idea to continue to fund this entity when we're not really getting good ROI, when we're really not getting results that make sense for what we're funding. Is that a crazy, wild idea? Is that something that is so beyond the pale of reasonable thought? I don't think so at all. I don't think that that's anything that's crazy at all. You've got a bloated federal entity, a bloated federal agency that is proving that what they're spending money on is just not working. What they're spending money on is just not, it's not working for the vast majority of American people. It just doesn't make sense to continue to fund it at the levels when you're not getting the results. What's a better solution? Give the money to the states. Get the federal government out of there and allow state leaders and local officials, again, your most local form of government, which would be in this case, your local county board of education, to make decisions. Right? Let those individuals be the ones that are responsible for funding. Let those ones be the ones that are responsible for education. I mean, here's an incredibly damning chart from the Cato Institute that went out to 2012. This is the trends in inflation adjusted cost of a complete K-12 public education. And you can see the blue line is cost, which is completely going at a 90 degree angle. And then you've got reading, math, and science scores, which have essentially been unchanged since the 70s. So you spend more and more and more and more and more money, and you are not getting a better result. No business would do this. No private individual would do this, would continue to spend this kind of money with these lackluster results. But at the federal government, as we know, that's not an issue. At the federal government, we continue to spend, and it just seemingly doesn't ever have an impact. It's a huge problem that we deal with. President Donald Trump's plan is to essentially abolish the Department of Education, to keep it responsible for things like Title IX violations, dealing with children with disabilities, you know, obviously things like FAFSA, which are federal programs for college student loans and college financing. Keep it for those things, sure. But when you look at K-12 education, the vast majority of K-12 education, there's no reason that the Department of Education needs to be in there. Trump has said ultimately he wants to see it abolished and the power move back to states and local communities. Right? That's quintessential conservatism right there. Let local individuals, people that you can actually affect change over, right? You're unhappy with who's on your board of education. You have an opportunity every 4 years to get rid of them. You don't like who's up in Raleigh making decisions on education funding. You've got an opportunity every 2 years to get rid of them. What opportunity do you have to affect change at the United States Department of Education? The answer is none. The only thing that you can do is vote for a president. Hope that the president puts somebody in that's that can actually affect change and do it. You're like three or four steps removed from any change. That's not good. It's a bad investment. It's been bad ROI. And this is a major decision by the courts and one that I absolutely applaud. And once again, the president being blocked by Democrats. Democrats using their friends in the court system to try and block this administration from carrying out their goals, carrying out their objectives, things that President Trump not only ran on, but then won on, yet the left doesn't like that. They don't like that the president is slashing the Department of Education. They don't like that the president is turning away and destroying their toy. The grift that they've been running at the federal level. So sad, too bad. You guys lost. You're not in charge. We're leading the charge now. We're the ones that are pulling the strings. And we say the Department of Education is done. And so I look forward to President Donald Trump and Secretary McMahon working in a very expeditious manner to get rid of the Department of Education and give that funding back to the states. Let them determine how to spend it. Let local board of educations make decisions and make rules for education within their local school districts without having to be beholden to a federal bureaucracy in Washington, D.C. This is a great, great thing yesterday from the Department of Education. We'll keep an eye on that. The legal battle does continue, but that temporary injunction, which said that President Trump had to hire all of these people back, that is gone, and that is well applauded this morning. In some other news, President Donald Trump is continuing to show his frustration with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Yesterday, he was in the White House with NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte, who, of course, we heard from back just a couple of weeks ago when Trump was at the NATO summit. We heard from the NATO secretary about how President Donald Trump has led the charge to all of the NATO countries getting their spending up to 5%. None of this would be possible without President Donald Trump. And well, the president making some pretty strong claims in the Oval Office yesterday. Take a listen.
It's a honor, great honor, to have a friend of mine who's become very friendly over the last number of years. We knew each other before, but Mark is the head of NATO, Mark Rutte, Secretary General of NATO, highly respected by everybody that knows him, but in particular the European countries. They have great reliance on him, and he's done a fantastic job. And we had a tremendous meeting, I guess it's about a month ago, and I think Mark will tell you that it was really perhaps more important the date of November 5th, that was the election day, maybe that was the most important, because we've made tremendous progress together. And one of the reasons that you're here today is to hear that we are very unhappy, I am, with Russia. But we'll discuss that maybe a different day. But we're very, very unhappy with them, and we're going to be doing very severe tariffs if we don't have a deal in 50 days. Tariffs at about 100%. You'd call them secondary tariffs. You know what that means. But today we're going to talk about something else. And as you know, we've spent $350 billion approximately on this war with Russia and Ukraine. And would like to see it end. It wasn't my war, it was Biden's war. It's not my war, I'm trying to get you out of it. And we want to see it end. And I'm disappointed in President Putin because I thought we would have had a deal 2 months ago, but it doesn't seem to get there. So based on that, we're going to be doing secondary tariffs. If we don't have a deal in 50 days, it's very simple. And they'll be at 100%. And that's the way it is. That can be more simple. It's just the way it is. I hope we don't have to do it. But regardless, we are going to be we make the greatest military equipment in the world, whether it's missiles. You saw that recently in Iran, the way those planes flew in. They had every.
So you've got the president announcing 100% tariffs on Russia if a ceasefire deal is not met in 50 days. And I think this goes to show you the continued struggle that the president is having with Russian President Vladimir Putin. You know, there's been a lot of rumor. There's been a lot of conversation. And you know, I've even made the point. Putin is not interested in peace. This point has been, to me, obviously clear for quite some time. I think the president has tried his damnedest. He's tried his best to bring the Russian president to the table to negotiate. But the reality is he's not interested in peace. He's not interested in ending the war. He wants to restore what was the Soviet Union in terms of land. That has been his mission. That is why he waged war against Ukraine. He got essentially a wink, wink, and a nod, nod from President Joe Biden to just go forward with it. Oh, it's a minor incursion, no problem whatsoever. And that's exactly what he did. The president has tried to negotiate from, you know, the best of my records. There's been probably half a dozen phone calls between Trump and Vladimir Putin since he's been in the Oval Office. There may have been more maybe that we don't know about, but at least half a dozen public calls that have been announced and discussed and talked about. And it's obvious that Putin's just not interested. So now Trump says we're going to impose secondary, very steep tariffs on Russia if there's no peace deal in 50 days. And so that's going to put Vladimir Putin in a tough situation where if he actually wants peace, he's going to have to put up or shut up, or he's going to have to deal with hopefully crippling tariffs from the United States. You know, these secondary tariffs would be imposed on other countries doing business with Russia, not exports to the United States. And so this is unfortunately the situation that we're in right now. And we even heard from the NATO Secretary General. This was his quote. If I was Vladimir Putin today speaking about what you're planning to do in 50 days and this announcement, I would reconsider whether I should take negotiations about Ukraine more seriously than I was doing in the moment. But when I'm Ukraine, I think this is really good news for them. And I mean, it makes perfect sense. If Putin is not serious about coming to the negotiating table, if he's not actually interested in peace, of which I don't believe that he is, then this is the solution. He is not willing to listen to reason. He is not interested in coming to some sort of peace agreement because it will make him look weak. There have been rumors and rumblings that if a peace deal is made, that there will be a major power overhaul in Russia, that there's discussions that if there's some sort of peace deal made, he could potentially lose power. So there's a lot at stake for Putin. He thought he could steamroll Ukraine in the matter of a couple of days, if not maybe a couple of weeks. It's gone on for years now, no end in sight. The United States has been on the hook for hundreds of billions of dollars. It's not sustainable. This is essentially Trump's final option. He can't force the Russians to the negotiating table. He can't force them to sign a peace deal. But his attempt here will probably be to try and cripple their economy as much as possible and force the Russian president, force Vladimir Putin to have good faith negotiations on what a peace deal is. I would hope and assume, after all we've heard, that Ukraine is interested in peace. It seems like that's the case. Whether that actually plays out is maybe a different discussion. Of course, we saw Zelensky's antics here in the United States earlier this year, back in March in the Oval Office, where Trump and J.D. Vance tag-teamed him like a wrestling duo over the nonsense that he was spewing to the American media. Trump wants peace. The president is frustrated with this war. He's frustrated with the U.S. involvement, and he's obviously incredibly pissed off that Putin is speaking out of both sides of his mouth, says he wants peace, says he wants this, but he's not actually interested in it. So the clock started yesterday, 50 days. We are now 49 days from that deadline, and we will see between President Trump and some of the other groups and some of the other ambassadors here in the United States, if they're able to get to a deal, or we see some more crippling tariffs in and around Russia's economy to force their hand into a peace agreement. It's going to be an interesting process to watch. We will keep an eye on the details right here on the Nick Craig Show. Well, that's going to do it for a busy Tuesday edition. Thanks for spending some time with us. Thanks to the Law Group here in Wilmington for their continued support. Give them a call at 910-251-6088 or visit them online at lawgroupnc.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the channel on YouTube, Rumble, or follow the show on X. Rate the show in your favorite podcast app. It is greatly appreciated. That's going to do it for a Tuesday edition of the Nick Craig Show, streaming live on YouTube, Rumble, and X, 7 a.m. and 24/7, wherever you get your podcasts.